The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Bert Rockman and Andrew Rudilevich to talk to us about their new book, The Obama Legacy. This book was published in 2019 by the University Press of Kansas, and it is an edited volume that collects some really interesting scholarship in helping us think about not only the Obama presidency, but also the long-range understanding of Obama, his administration, the policies, the politics, the partisanship, et cetera, thereof. But I'm going to let Bert and Andrew talk to us a little bit about them. That first, I'd like to invite Bert Rockman and Andrew Rudilevich to tell us each a little bit about themselves and how they came to this particular project. Hello, Bert and Andy.
Yes. This is Bert. I came to this project, actually, I believe it was in the early 1990s. We were approached by with Colin Campbell, who was then at Georgetown University, and I were approached by Ed Artinian, who was the publisher and proprietor of Chatham House Publications, to do a book, a series of books on the legacies of presidents. And George Bush, or George Bush 41, as we now know him, was in his first, and as it matters turned out, only term. And so this book series really began with the Bush 41 presidency, and then it went on through the three other publishers. University Press of Kansas is the most recent one, and we were happy to have University Press of Kansas publish the book because it has a wonderful set of books on the presidency and a very substantial reputation in that. So this is and Andy came on, I believe, sometime. Let's see, it must have been about 2000, I think. With the George W. Bush presidency, and so we had three editors for a time, and then Colin retired, and so Andy and I are the current editors, and we will have a third, Julia Azari, coming on for the next edition.
Yeah, my involvement in the series. This is Andy Rudilevich. Began with, I believe, the George W. Bush legacy. So the series in the whole has looked at the appraisals of a first term and prospects for a second, and then at the end of a term has looked at the legacy of that president. And so this is the second Obama volume, but as Bert mentioned, the first with University Press of Kansas. One of the reasons for shifting publishers was really the publication deadline. Kansas was willing to let us wait a little bit so that we would be able to better appraise the legacy of the president. Earlier volumes, because of the heavy pressure on classroom adoption, had been coming out before the president had actually left office. And this ran the real risk of missing late term events that might be important to assessing that legacy. So we're delighted with Kansas being willing to let us actually do that assessment in a more systematic, scholarly way.
And this book is really a wonderful overview of the Obama election. So you have a lot of great data with regard to the electoral outcomes in 2008 and 2012. You also have, you know, really digging into policy deliberations and processes and the partisanship that marked also those 8 years. So I'd love to have you talk a little bit about the approaches that you sort of pulled together in this edited volume, the various authors and the sort of highlights of some of the chapters that came in as they were coming in, what surprises you might have found in reading work by some of your colleagues in analyzing the Obama legacy.
Andy, do you want to begin with that?
Sure. I mean, for all these volumes, of course, you're looking to recruit a mix of authors who are going to be able to provide a relatively objective view of the pros and cons, the hits and misses of a given administration. And so we were looking for people who, were ethologically sound, but also who represented a variety of views within the presidency subfield. And we were delighted that we were able to get, I think, a pretty widely diverse group of scholars, a lot of young scholars involved, who, were not necessarily the same old faces and voices that we've tended to hear from. And so that, I think, was a plus. It did allow for a fresh vantage. We've got, folks who are sort of becoming more prominent in the field. I would say people like Molly Reynolds, Charisse Thrower, of course, Julia Azari, some folks who are well established. In terms of surprises, this is a field we've, lived through and looked at for a long time. But I would say not a surprise exactly, but the fact that so much can be explained by polarization and partisanship in terms of both the president's approach to policy over time and the learning that occurred as he realized that there was going to be effectively no bipartisan support for anything he did, even for a president taking office in the midst of, instead of peace and prosperity, war and depression, or at least great recession, that there was really going to be no party crossover, that the lesson Republicans took from the 2008 election was that they should oppose everything that the president did. You could argue Democrats have now learned that lesson pretty well themselves moving forward. And so to see that not just in, the Obama and Congress chapter or the Obama and the political parties chapter, but really throughout the book, everything from race to the judiciary, I think was striking at the very least.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that one of the things that we were able to pick up from this is how important context is. And I think particularly in Julia Azari's chapter, which very explicitly points out what I think are underlying tones in other chapters, that we're living in a partisan era, deeply partisan era, without, however, a great deal of attention to party organization. And probably what has been said about Obama in that regard, that is existing in a partisan era, is probably somewhat appropriated to the current incumbent as well. Partisan era, he hasn't paid a whole lot of attention to building up the political party, so to speak, but he has certainly acquired a heavy degree of followership in the party. I think the other thing, however, is that legacies are incredibly tenuous. the current incumbent is obviously Trump has obviously been adamant about erasing Obama's legacy, such as it was. And undoubtedly, whoever succeeds him will be adamant on erasing his legacy. In fact, that if there's anything that unites the Democratic candidates, it is fundamentally that that they want to get rid of whatever it is that Trump has been doing and his conduct in the presidency. So legacies are tenuous unless something, some extraordinary social or international events have stamped it.
And that's one of the components of the book. What I found in reading through it is, yes, the partisanship and the polarization is threaded through each chapter. And it's not something that is just in the chapters, as you note, about Obama's relationship with the Republicans in Congress. It's in each chapter. But I also found to be interesting, as you also noted, is the issue around party leadership and party building that also seem to be structured into so much of the discussion throughout the book in terms of questions of legacy and that, you know, Obama kept losing positions, kept losing people in the House, kept losing people in the Senate, kept losing governor's offices, kept losing state legislatures, or the Democratic Party kept losing all of these during the Obama period. And we're seeing potentially, again, that kind of dynamic during the Trump administration. And so I would ask you both a little bit about sort of these waves of sort of back and forth, you know, the sort of divided government constantly, but also the undermining or sort of pulling apart of the parties themselves.
The separation of powers and the division of government has certainly produced intense partisanship with zero result for the most part. And we're likely to be in a period that one doesn't know how far it will extend, but it certainly seems to have quite a bit of momentum now that presidents are going to be, if they try to do, you know, things, whatever they try to do, are going to create enormous amount of opposition. And the opposition is much more easily put together and activated now than it would have been, let's say, even as short a time as 20 years ago. It's a lot easier to have the cost, I guess, put it this way. The cost of collective action in the internet era are relatively small compared to what they used to be. So it's pretty easy to activate activists around the country. And that, I think, means that over time, it's going to be very, very hard to get governing coalitions. Trump has been talking about all that he's done, but the fact of the matter is he's done very little. And it looks to me like that will continue to be the case over the immediately foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think you wind up with a couple of interesting results. For one thing, it's obviously very hard to do anything in Congress, given the, you know, the filibuster rule in the Senate, if nothing else, the sort of decline, again, of any sort of ability to reach across the aisle. And, you know, that's obviously exacerbated right now with impeachment debates. But going back to the Obama administration, again, the sort of strategic decision that opposition was the way to generate support for Republicans in Congress over time. And that proved to be successful, right? You wound up with a backlash electorally against the Democrats that, of course, shifts the House back to the Republican side after 2010 and the Senate after 2014, and a huge wave of state legislatures as well, governorships going on at this time. So one result of that in turn is that, of course, Obama turns to a more executive-centered and administrative strategy, trying to change regulations, issuing executive orders and memoranda. And this in turn drives a lot of things to the courts. Also, as Bert mentioned earlier, tees them up for a certain level of fragility in the Trump administration. Any successor is going to have a good deal of discretion to wipe away executive action through subsequent executive action. So I think this sort of reliance on executive action instead of legislation has made it more difficult for presidents generally to have a legacy. It also perhaps leads to, you know, a broader difficulty for presidents in trying to change the underlying institutions, right? There's a lot of rhetoric flying around. Al Tillery's chapter is pretty interesting. I think he talks about Obama's relationship with African Americans, and there's a fair bit of literature out there that's disappointed in Obama. He didn't do enough. Al points out that Obama was a very, active in terms of his rhetoric, in terms of his appointments, in terms of his attempts to build up, equal protection of the laws, but that the underlying institutions were not particularly receptive to that. And so, you know, generally the outcomes were much less than the rhetoric, though the rhetoric was sometimes beautiful. So I think, again, there, the inability to build bipartisan coalitions makes it very difficult for underlying institutional change.
And that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, was not only the Tillery chapter, but the next chapter in the book, Obama's Latino Legacy, From Unknown to Never Forgotten, in terms of, again, some of the questions of legacy and integration of various demographic groups within the Democratic Party, but also the policy dimensions. And as you note, with regard to Tillery's chapter, there was a lot of obvious support from the African-American community for the nation's first Black president. But then there was also a lot of, not necessarily disappointment or some disappointment, but also sort of, you know, not all that much came in terms of policy per se. And what about the legacy with regard to other demographic groups that Obama also sort of said going to lift up? And so how does that play out with regard to his legacy?
Well, you know, it's a problem actually for Democratic presidents, at least in the current era. Republican presidents generally have one, in recent times, of one constituency. And that's basically white people, particularly older white people, particularly older white males. And that's to the extent that concentrated is the right term here. They're largely concentrated in exurban and rural areas. So the Trump presidency is a case in which that focus has been extraordinarily persistent and much more evident than it has been in prior Republican administrations. But it's been there, at least in relatively recent decades, certainly since the Reagan administration for certain. The Democrats have a bigger problem because they're composed of a whole variety of demographics, and all of which make some demands. All of which, none of which, feel that they've have all their desires fulfilled, and that becomes a bigger problem for any Democratic president. Now, particularly when a Democratic president is a minority oneself, that the expectations become much larger. And they would, if, let's say, Kamala Harris or Cory Booker or Julio Castro, any of the minority Democratic candidates were to become president, the group that they represent, simply demographically, would probably never be satisfied with what they do, because, of course, they have to be president of the United States, not just a single demographic. And as Andy was saying earlier, it's harder to get things through Congress in the form of legislation. So I think that this tension is really going to be there for the foreseeable future.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it is worth pointing to the Gutierrez Ocampo Barreto chapter on Latino politics and Obama, because of course his original campaign in 2008 is up against the backdrop of traditional American urban politics, where Latinos and African Americans are not always allied, certainly at the city level. And so there was a good deal of question, in fact, whether he would be able to attract Latino support. In his first term, he's known as the deporter in chief, right? There's very aggressive actions by the administration to try to build up the president's credentials on border security, ironically, in order to give him some leeway, he hopes, to build a wider coalition on broader immigration reform. That, of course, never happens. It does make it through the Senate, but does not get enacted. And so he begins to turn here as in other areas to executive action. And it's here that he is able then to broaden that base with DACA, of course, leading up to the 2012 election, and then in 2014, the much wider DAPA program. And of course, we're still arguing about the former, as President Trump has tried to roll that back. DAPA winds up in court, but clearly, the signals sent to the Latino community are unmistakable and positive. And of course, he does adopt other positions as well in terms of outreach to Cuba and the like, that begin to cement that. It's all against the backdrop, of course, of the 2012 campaign, where Governor Romney at the time is attacking, immigration. He's talking about self-deportation and very tough policies. Intriguingly, of course, the Republican Party winds up deciding as a body. You remember the autopsy after the 2012 election, where they decided, yeah, we need to actually be much more inclusive. We need to go back to the sort of George W. Bush approach of compassionate conservatism with regards to immigration. That, of course, is a policy very explicitly rejected by the Trump campaign, and successfully so. Perhaps one result here will be the, I don't think it was an obvious outcome 10 or 15 years ago, the Latinos would be solidly Democratic, but that seems to be the likely outcome now, that in fact the Democratic base grows in that direction as well, even though, again, that perhaps did not have to be the inevitable outcome, but the way that the parties have shifted, that becomes more likely.
Wanted to follow up on that and ask you, Andy, specifically about the chapter that you wrote about Obama as imperial or imperiled, and the way that it also follows on Alyssa Julian's and John Graham's chapter on the second term domestic agenda, and what it is that you are trying to get at in the way that you're thinking about the way that Obama conducted himself as president with regard to this sort of question of imperialism.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating development to see, President Obama came into office attacking the excesses, as he saw them, of the George W. Bush administration with regards to executive action, specifically in the war powers. I think one thing that the Obama administration cements and you know, that the Trump administration has only added to is the notion that if you can't pass new laws, the key tactic is to reinterpret old laws. And that was very much in the forefront of a lot of Obama's policies. You know, new laws, again, could not be passed after 2010. Lots were passed before 2010, it should be remembered, when there were large Democratic majorities. You know, big statutory change did occur in the beginning of the Obama administration. But after that, it's a question of issuing the regulations and, as I say, interpreting older laws like the Clean Air Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act, and all the way over to the War Powers Resolution in ways that benefited the president's preferences. So Obama rejected the idea that George W. Bush had put forth that there was a sense of presidential prerogative that you could override statute, especially in wartime, to achieve the outcomes the president thought were necessary. Obama, you know, made it very clear he wanted all of his actions to be based in statute or in the Constitution. But it turns out that if you hire good lawyers, pretty much anything you want to do can be justified by statute and the Constitution. And so you don't necessarily see a retrenchment of the administrative presidency in Obama. Indeed, you see an expansion, I think. So it turned, you know, I think one interesting aspect of that, as I alluded to earlier, is the fact that this is a fragile legacy, right? Regulations take longer to change, but they can be changed. Executive orders can be changed in the with a signature. And so, you know, I think in the end, the legacy that Obama was able to establish, and I'm not sure he had a good different option in mind or available to him, you know, is going to be subject sort of to the whims of his successors. I wouldn't mind coming back at some point to the war power side of this, because I think that's a question where we can look really at Congress's abrogation of its own power in a pretty significant way. But we can swing back to that when you think it's a good idea.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think Andy put his finger on a very, very important trend here, which is why the judiciary has really become fundamentally the most important now of the three branches of government, because they get to decide, you know, what basically the validity of executive discretion and in any given instance. And so we understand now why the judiciary has become so heavily politicized, not necessarily that the judges are, but the perception of the importance of the nomination process and getting judges through that, you know, basically are going to divide along party lines is now the expectation. And that's precisely because of the growth of the executive presidency.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that in context also of your chapter, Bert, which is, again, you know, the leadership style and legacy of Obama, comparisons and complexities, which also acts as a kind of conclusive chapter for the book as a whole. And what you see in terms of those comparisons, I know we've talked a little bit about the comparison between Obama and Trump, obviously, going forward. But a little bit of also the comparisons going backwards, and you've been involved in these kinds of publications that are sort of retrospective and prospective for quite some time, and obviously you're both scholars of the presidency. So I'm curious about the sort of discussion of his particular leadership style and how that also impacted his legacy.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the points that I was trying to make in that chapter, though, is that the personal element of a presidency is probably the aspect that's likely to be the most ephemeral, because every president is different. Now, that that might not be the case with Trump, but I think in Obama's case, you tend to get, as you do with most, you tend to get a reaction from one president's style to another president's style. And I think Obama, as I kind of indicated, without trying to fall into some kind of worship of the, you know, of the person, was somebody of very even temperament. You know, there was the no drama Obama was the line, I think. Person of considerable intellect. Insofar as there were really no issues involved with his character or moral issues, seemed to be, you know, the kind of president one might hope that we have more of, putting aside whatever positions, you know, that is political positions that person is holding. So the tendency, however, is to get somebody almost exactly in reverse of the person who preceded, you know, that individual. So, you know, even if they're the same party, Reagan came in, you know, presumably to, in some ways, like Trump, but without Trump's personality, basically to diminish government, to diminish its importance, its size, and its executive functioning, and then was replaced by Bush 41, who was very experienced in government, respected government, didn't necessarily, you know, that's aside from how large it should be, what its power should be, and so forth. But one of the first things he did was to meet with the senior civil servants and basically tell them how much, you know, he regarded and respected their role. So these personal differences do, you know, strongly arise, I think, and they usually arise as a consequence of, well, 8 years in office or whatever, that's, you know, that's a long time. Maybe we need something different, you know. And so I don't know how much of a legacy Obama's own, you know, personal characteristics are, so much as they may have been a reaction to those of George W. Bush and Trump in turn to Obama.
And that's what you've also, you know, you've sort of highlighting this as what you've been able to sort of assess in previous volumes as well. When you look at leadership style, and as you say, it seems to be quite, it can be quite ephemeral as history moves on.
Yes, I think you know, to go back to context a bit, a lot depends upon what happens in both international and national contexts. And why do we remember Lincoln? We remember Lincoln because of the tearing up of the U.S. political system, the Civil War. We remember Franklin Roosevelt because of the international challenges and the domestic challenges. You know, so we have these perceptions of greatness as a consequence of the nature of the challenges facing the presidents. And I think it was Bill Clinton who kept, you know, worrying about not being considered to be a great president in history because he was living during normal times, you know, and they were good times. You know, so it is the context, I think, that matters a great deal.
So is this why Bill decided to make his own trouble?
Andy,
Bill,
go ahead.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we seem to be living a little bit through some of the own trouble sometimes right now. Andy, I wanted to loop back to you because you did say you wanted to talk a little bit more about this question of presidents and President Obama's legacy around questions of war powers. And the chapter after yours, which is also about foreign entanglements and some of the discussion with regard to the partisanship in Congress and foreign entanglements. I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. So there's a couple pieces here. You know, Bert is talking about the importance, at least within a presidency, of the president's character and personality. You know, the scholarship, of course, on the presidency has argued for a long time about the relative impact of character versus institutional pressures, constraints, incentives. And I think on the war power side, certainly you have a lot of the latter, right? The president certainly, you know, he gave a speech in I think May 2009 talking about how we had gone too far in our in the war on terror in regards to things like surveillance, in regards to the sort of unilateral expansion of presidential authority in addressing terrorism. And yet, you know, the Obama record effectively is one of continuation, at least of the second part of the Bush administration, maybe not the first part, the immediate post 9/11 part, in terms of, well, one of the things I was talking about before, Obama didn't want to claim prerogative power. But if you look at his interpretation of both the authorization for the use of military force that was passed in 2001 and the War Powers Resolution, you see some very creative and authority expanding interpretations of those statutes. In the first case, right, the AUMF is extended well beyond al-Qaeda into the war on ISIS, right? ISIS, of course, a group that didn't exist in 2001, and that resolution speaks specifically to those who attacked the United States in that atrocity, right? There's not a so basically the extension of the AUMF to one, two, three, I don't know, 6 degrees of separation, perhaps, from the original perpetrators is one important legal interpretation the Obama administration made and that the Trump administration has picked up on. On the war power side, you'll remember in 2011 in Libya, there's a lot of question about whether the U.S. could move forward with the NATO military operation there after the time in the War Powers Resolution had expired. The administration got around that problem by redefining the Libya operation as not a war. It's not hostilities, partly and somewhat comically, I have to say, because the Libyans were not shooting back at us. Therefore, it could have been hostile. You know, to people on the ground, they might have a different opinion of that definition. But Obama trying to sort of define the War Powers Resolution as only applicable to wars the size of Vietnam, effectively, is another legacy and one, again, that the Trump administration has picked up on as it deals with, say, its airstrikes on Syria. So there are some, you know, continuities in policy and in the kinds of claims made about presidential authority that I think will be longer lasting. Again, helped along by Congress's, you know, utter failure, really, to deal seriously with its own authority in the Constitution regarding war making. Broader points about foreign policy, yeah, Dave Houghton's chapter, which is, you know, derived from the don't do stupid stuff, though the word wasn't stuff, that became the motto for Obama's foreign policy, really tracks through, you know, some of the skepticism that the administration had about broader interventions, certainly new interventions. He was pretty realistic and skeptical about interventions that might lead to limitless commitments. And for some, you know, that was a failure, right? For some, this sort of push towards multilateralism was a desertion of American leadership. But basically, the idea of just not doing things that could turn out badly is looking relatively refreshing in the aftermath of that. And but again, you have longer term arguments about the general role of the United States in the world, how expansive our policy should be. Obama, on the whole, was very open to globalization and multilateralism. And that, of course, we're seeing, again, a reaction to in the current administration.
And Bert, would you like to add anything to those last bits?
I think Andy more or less said it all. Of the, you know, presidents are going to try to find whatever room they have to maneuver and to be able to hold those decisions within the executive. And I think that's a secular trend that has been going on now for quite some time. It's also the case that, as Andy pointed out, that Congress has been utterly remiss, essentially, in being able to hold to legislate and to oversee the executive. And in part, now what we are currently seeing is essentially that the executive is staving off Congress's right to oversee, and largely because the committees are no longer have any kind of connection across the parties. They've all become a function of the partisanship that is pervading the system as a whole. So we saw that in the impeachment vote, but the resolution to open an impeachment inquiry, almost exactly along party lines. And the more that there is that, the less that Congress is going to be able to function.
And that, again, is, you know, as you note throughout the book, is something that is in each chapter as part of the Obama presidency and now the legacy of that time as well, in part because of the capacity to, as you say, create enormous amounts of opposition to themselves with great ease. So I wanted to ask you both about what you're working on now, besides the potential next book in this series, which you're individually working on, looking forward.
Well, I guess I could start off with that, since I'm not supposed to be working at this point, but I've been doing some work on populism and from a kind of international standpoint, but heavily focused also in the U.S., the impacts of it, the threat to constitutional and liberal democratic elements and the institutional bases of governance, meaning particularly the bureaucracy, or what I guess these days is being called the deep state, which kind of connects us both to the past and to the brain of government, essentially, and to the courts. So that's one thing. The other thing is kind of completely different, which is I'm working on healthcare, a book on healthcare policy, and I've done several papers on this now about particularly single payer and what would be a kind of most efficient but nonetheless very costly reworking of the U.S. healthcare system.
Great, Andy.
Yeah, well, as you say, the next book could be the Trump legacy, or it could be Trump appraisals and prospects. I guess. Kind of depends on House and Senate at this point, as well as on the electorate. But most of my work at the moment is about aspects of the administrative presidency. Have a paper I'm working on about Trump and the deep state, the subtitle of which is A Love Story. Partly because, in fact, as we've noted, it's so hard to get things through Congress that I think most of the substantive achievements of the Trump administration will actually be through the administration that he claims to deplore so very much. But the larger projects, I'm writing, finishing up, I say, knocking on wood, a manuscript that with luck will be out with Princeton towards the end of next year on executive orders, specifically on the formulation process that lies behind executive orders and the ways in which presidents manage the bureaucracy in order to achieve those orders, but also how the bureaucracy seeks to manage the president. On what George Krauss long ago called a two-way street. A bigger project that's ongoing is a very large institutional history of the Office of Management and Budget, which has popped up again in the news as the issue of Ukrainian military aid has arisen, but keeps getting called an obscure but powerful agency. Well, that's been what it's called since 21. So I'm working with Matt Dickinson up at Middlebury College on that manuscript. And again, it's a long-term effort. If any of your readers are former OMB staffers, I would love to hear from you.
Okay. We put the call out here on the New Books Network. So when each of you finish the next book, I hope that you'll come on separately to talk to me about your particular projects. And also, of course, when the Trump Legacy book comes out, whenever that is, I hope you'll both come on also with Dr. Azari to talk about that book. So I wanted to thank you both for being with me today to talk about The Obama Legacy. This new book came out with University Press of Kansas in 2019 and is edited by Bert Rockman and Andrew Rudilevich. And I assume one can buy this at the University Press of Kansas website, as well as other places people buy books.
Indeed. Support your local bookstore.
Yes.
Support your local bookstore. Thank you both for being with me today.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Lo.
Thank you.